by Georges Picot, carved up the Ottoman Empire into British and French spheres of influence. The borders were largely arbitrary, with little regard for ethnicity or religion of the local populations. France would receive modern-day Syria and Lebanon, as well as parts of Turkey and Iraq, while Britain claimed the rest of modern-day Iraq and southern and eastern Palestine. The remainder of the territory was to be under international control.
What the British are really looking for is an extra large buffer zone, again for the Suez Canal. It's all about the Suez Canal. The idea of making Palestine an international area, it's really because the British don't want to give this to the French, but the French don't want the British to have it. So it's a compromise. And in fact, this whole agreement is a compromise. It's a wartime compromise between two countries that happen to be allies, but are both still big political and imperial rivals. And they will go back to being imperial rivals after the First World War.
Having already made commitments to Arab nationalists and the French government, in November 1917, the British made one more promise regarding the land in Palestine, this time to Zionists seeking to set up a national Jewish state. Zionism was a social movement that began in the 1800s. It was founded on the belief that Judaism was not only a religion, but a nationality, and that Jewish people deserved a state like British or French people did. Due to historical and religious ties to the region, Palestine became the desired location for this future Jewish state.
So this armband or brassard was worn by a Palestinian Jewish volunteer with British forces serving in that area of the Middle East during 1918. Interestingly, there were three battalions of Jewish volunteers, one battalion of British, one of Americans, and one of Palestinian Jews. The British volunteers weren't really interested in Zionism at all. They were more interested in using that military service to the Crown, to assimilate into British society. It was really the American volunteers and the local Jewish volunteers from Palestine who were really fired up by Zionism and wanted to use this to defeat the Ottoman Empire and secure that Jewish homeland. So what this object shows us and the story behind it is that although Zionism was a popular movement, the majority of Jews were not Zionists and didn't want to move to Palestine.
Jewish immigration to Palestine had been slowly increasing throughout the 1900s, mainly fueled by brutal anti-Semitism and terrible pogroms in Russia. By 1914, the Jews in Palestine numbered around 60,000, or 8% of the population. But for the British, it was Zionists elsewhere that they were concerned with. In an effort to win the support of Jewish communities in both Allied countries like the United States and enemy countries like Austria-Hungary, the UK Foreign Secretary signed the Balfour Declaration, vowing to set up a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine.
So the Balfour Declaration is signed in late 1917, in fact just after Allenby's victory at the Third Battle of Gaza. And this map shows the situation just before that battle. And it shows the confidence that the British have that they are going to win the war in the Middle East. Let's face it, on this map, they haven't taken all of this territory yet, but they're already looking at the post-war settlement in this area. There are people within the British cabinet, Prime Minister Lloyd George is one of them, who thinks that having a Jewish homeland in Palestine is the right thing to do. But it's also politically expedient. The British and French war efforts by this time are pretty much under pressure. There's a manpower crisis, there's a crisis in raw materials. The Americans have joined the war in April 1917, and we really need the Americans to ramp up and get stuck into the war effort. So the idea is by supporting this Zionist idea, it will get Jewish financiers and industrialists in America on side, and they will put big pressure on the American government to keep them involved in the First World War and fight for the Allied cause. And this idea, this is an anti-Semitic idea, that the Jews control world finance and business across capitalist countries. And that idea takes hold and is one of the reasons we think they can put pressure on the American government.
The declaration was vague. It said that the homeland would be in Palestine, but didn't say where. It also vowed to protect civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities, but made no mention of their political rights. For the British, these conflicting promises were worth making to assure that they came out on top in the world's first total war. And they were effective. Britain and France were victorious over the Central Powers in 1918. But now that the war was at an end, the British would have to face the consequences. The choices they made would help to spark a century of conflict. Having captured Damascus in 1918, the British military left Faisal and his men in charge of a military occupation zone, an area that Faisal declared the Arab Kingdom of Syria. However, the French were not happy. Hoping to maintain their influence in the region, they expelled Faisal in a short war. It was a crushing blow to the pan-Arab cause. Instead, it was the victorious Allied powers who drew the new borders of the Middle East in a series of conferences from 1919 to 1923. With the formation of the League of Nations, Britain and France took control under a series of mandates. These were intended to prepare the local populations for independence. Initially, France was given the mandates for Syria and Lebanon, while Britain was given the mandates for Mesopotamia and Palestine. But after Faisal's defeat, the British decided to split Palestine in two. Faisal was given the crown of Mesopotamia, and his brother, Abdullah, was given the crown of the newly created Transjordan. The remainder of Palestine would be strictly British.
So this 1924 map shows the Palestine that came into being after the First World War. It is not part of a pan-Arab state. In fact, there is no pan-Arab state in this region. Also, it is not an internationally controlled area or an area in which the French have any control at all. It is a British-administered League of Nations mandate. What this mandate of Palestine does have, however, written into its statute, is the Balfour Declaration of a home for the Jewish people in Palestine.
Jewish immigration to Mandatory Palestine continued to grow. By 1931, there were 176,000 Jewish people living there, making up 17% of the population. This led to increased tensions, riots, and violence between the new arrivals and local Arabs, who, along with existing Christian populations, were starting to see themselves not only as Arabs, but as distinctly Palestinian people.
What these new Jewish settlers bring in is lots of financial backing, and they start to buy up more and more land. So it's more the fertile agricultural land of Palestine, which actually makes the Jewish population increasingly economically dominant in the area. The British government gets very, very worried about this. In 1930, the colonial secretary puts forward a white paper to drastically limit Jewish immigration into the Palestine Mandate. The following year, 1931, pressure from Zionists within the British government and also world Zionist leaders talks Ramsay MacDonald in to dropping the white paper. And from that moment, there is no limit on Jewish immigration into Palestine.
This reversal coincided with events elsewhere that would supercharge the conflict. In 1933, Adolf Hitler came to power in Germany and began instituting a wave of anti-Semitic policies. This sent shockwaves through the Jewish communities of Europe. However, for those seeking to flee, options were few, with most governments maintaining strict limits on Jewish immigration. For many Jews, Zionists or not, travelling to Palestine became the only option. By 1936, the Jewish contingent inside Mandatory Palestine had doubled to 28% of the population. Now tensions began to escalate at an alarming rate. What began as a general strike among Palestinian Arabs in 1936 devolved into violent attacks on Jewish settlements and British military installations. This event became known as the Great Revolt.
From this point, really, you can see Palestinian Arab nationalism as opposed to pan-Arab nationalism. They're fighting against an issue, that Jewish homeland and British control in the region, that no other mandate or any other has to fight against. And they want their own Palestinian state, an independent country, free from British control.
The British response was to crush the revolt as quickly as possible with overwhelming strength. They brought a surge of new troops, more men than were serving in India at the time, and declared martial law in 1937. Favouring tactics of collective punishment, they destroyed homes and burned villages to the ground. They used aerial bombing, even on urban areas, and arrested, killed, or exiled Arab leaders, fracturing their movement.
In addition, the British use Jewish auxiliary units to fight the Arabs during the revolt. But this is a real turnaround from 1921, when they disband the Jewish Legion. Now, in 1936-37, the British are so overstretched that they really don't care. They just need boots on the ground to sort this situation out and to end this revolt as quickly as possible. So by the end of the Arab revolt, 17% of the Arab male population are either killed, wounded, imprisoned, or exiled. This really weakens the Arab cause in Palestine, just at the moment when the Jewish population is getting more and more power.
Okay, well, that was quite informative. I mean, it shows you the volatility that goes way back. And I guess if you had to say, or at least you would have to concentrate on the advent onset of the Zionist thinking, which proclaimed that Judaism was not just a religion, but rather a nationality, right? And that's the crux of the problem. So when you understand that, now when you look at that history, and in this case, I would say it's a question of, well, maybe we better just leave that alone and try to pick up when, I don't know, in 19, right after World War II, and certainly the influence of Hitler and the Holocaust changed the thinking. See, so all this is involved. I was caught by the idea that the Suez Canal played a role. And in 1950 some odd, I got an alert to be ready in 15 days to go to the Suez Canal because there was a problem. It was during Eisenhower's administration. And I, at that time, you know, was an obedient military individual, and I would have gone there, and I don't know what I would have done. Whatever the commanders said, and from that depiction, that little history that was given, see, the commanders are protecting the empire, whether it was the French, whether it was the British, or who else was in on the act, the French and the British, and they divided up the territory among themselves without much consideration for the people there, and set up a state of volatility that goes on to this day. Now the question is, how do you start to square this away? And a manifestation of the violence is, of course, in the current activity in Gaza. But how do you stop that? How do you bring it back? How do you get it to some point? It's almost, you would almost be tempted to say that it's beyond control, and that you almost are tempted. And I do think that there's an element of this thinking that you just step aside and let it reach its natural conclusion, which will be the elimination of the population that is interfering with the final determination of the boundaries of Israel. So I don't know how you proceed. At 1.2, it was mentioned there about the Young Turks. And that kind of explains, I guess, why that is used now among people who are seriously questioning policies, not only Israel-Palestine, but us nationally, the Young Turks under Unger, Kent Unger. So there we have that going on. And then we have our students that are reacting to the devastation, absolute devastation that is taking place, where the death toll is now, what, about 38,000 people with maybe 13,000 or plus children? You know, and then that flies in the face of Alito and his friends who are seeking to preserve the life of the unborn, and the born are being slaughtered left and right. See, there's so many contradictions that we face. So look.
It reminds me, the whole thing reminds me of the saying, you can't unscramble an egg.
Yeah.
You know, because it's so, you know, it goes back so far. And while you were speaking, Bill, it was just the parallel reminded me of what we went through in Iraq. you know, because Iraq was like a conglomeration of countries smushed together and became a tremendous mess, you know, with always some sort of thing we want from the region, access to the Suez Canal or oil. You know, there's always some sort of thing there. Had there not been, had the geography of the region not been beneficial, you know, to the first world countries, or had there not been a resource there that that people didn't want, would any of this have happened at all?
You know? Unscrambling the egg is the trouble. You know what? I think maybe we could take a look at something deeper, which would have to be at the basis of some kind of a settlement, some kind of an undoing, an unscrambling among the Israelis and the Palestinians. We could take a look at that. And I was thinking maybe we should or could use a bit of music now before we go into that. And I think I would suggest that we play Ronnie Drew, only because the older you get, see, the youth are the ones that sat down in the assembly area in the admin building, the youth. And the older folks are saying, man, we've been through this before. Maybe I should just bury my head in the sand. But yet, many of us can't do that. We have to keep reaching out for reconciliation and healing. I remember Roy Bourgeois, when we were so involved in the School of the Americas, a manifestation of a mechanism that we, the U.S., a manifestation of control that we developed in that school, training people to keep the population in order in Salvador and Guatemala and Honduras, et cetera, et cetera. He said, America sure needs a healing. You do need a healing. And we've seen instances of where this healing can occur. We've probably experienced it in our own lives when we've breached a terrible disruption in family life. It can happen. In national life, it's one heck of a different situation. But I do remember when the shooting took place in Charlotte, North in the Carolinas, and when the kid Ruth came in there and shot seven people at a Bible study. And of course, oh my God, that's akin to what the Muslim, what the Palestinians or whoever, the Hamas did on the 7th of October. But the day after that terrible shooting, when everybody was gathering and the press was there and the flames were being fanned, a group of people were over by the entry to the church. And they were prayerfully seeking forgiveness for what Ruth did. And the newscaster from MSNBC, who had insight into that and was covering, he couldn't believe that they were doing that. He started to cry and couldn't go on with the newscast. And then another guy stepped in, blah, 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 and he took over. But you see, when you see that happen, it's a traumatizing effect in a positive way. It traumatizes you to an all-embracing, people would call it Pollyanna-ish behavior and unicorns. No, it can happen, though. Individually, it can happen. In families, it can happen. And it can move in that direction. We talk about the bending of the arc. We saw that. And I said it to the students when I had an opportunity, the arc, you are playing a role in bending the arc. But the arc is so resistant. And the resistance comes in these national events from not being given the whole story. Britain didn't tell the truth when it was dividing it up. France didn't tell the truth when it wanted that. Didn't, whatever. And these big outfits, and as Captain Phil mentions, in Iraq, the British took away Kuwait, that territory. They took that away from Iraq to deprive them of seaport. More manipulation. in a volatile area that has a resource that makes the developed, quote-unquote, world function, oil. And Cheney comes in. And ironically, his daughter is one of our saviors. If I mean, she's, I wouldn't say a savior, because I think that's a term that we use when we think in terms of the dictator who wants to take over. Jesus' arms are on his shoulder as he proceeds to make this into a theocratic state, which will bring everybody under control. Women are okay now. We got them under control. But let's get Comstock, and that may start cutting off the supply of Viagra and Cialis. So it's just boggles the mind. But the healing can occur. So maybe play a piece of music, and then we'll go into this other consideration that I would like to do about that event that took place. And then we don't want to, let's see, big turns. Okay, let's just do that. Let's play a little music. How about Ronnie Drew? The old folks don't get discouraged, but they tend to. Let's play that, and then we'll come back with that other consideration and see what kind of additional light that may shine on things, okay?
You got it, Bill. You're listening to Lunch on Thursday with Bill McNulty. Just a program note, Chris Sorochin is in the studio right now. You can give him a call at 631-632-6901 and make a pledge in any amount. He'll be very happy to take your pledge, take your call, and tell you all about the WUSB pledge premiums as well. So please, and if you are intimidated to talk to the great Chris Sorochin, you can go to www.wusb.fm and pledge there as well. This is Ronnie Drew, the young man who used to be me.
When I was a young man, the skies were so clear. Sun always shone and we walked without fear. All of the houses were new, and we were the chosen few. Youth was the engine of change, we were told. To work with your hands was good for your soul. They pitched us their latest great scheme, and we all bought into the dream. Then one day I looked out my window. I knew then nothing would hold me, and I had to leave the young man that used to be me. The years brought surprises, fortune and fame, a house on the hill and a change in my name. Dreaming of what I might find, I left all my old clothes behind. Then one day I looked in my mirror, and I saw someone that scared me. A person so blinded by greed he just couldn't see. And I can't believe that young man used to be me. Now I respond to a different command. I no longer wipe the dirt from my hands. All of the houses are gone, and we dance to a different drum. The beggars still beg at the end of our street, but now when we pass, our eyes fail to meet. Where do the poor people go? Nobody wants to know. One day look out my window, and I'll see a prettier heaven, and I will return to the way my life used to be. And I will return to the way my life used to be.
All right, on that note, it's the youth that keeps the fire burning, you see. And
thank you very much.
I see the image of those young people at the courthouse saying, hey, hold your head up high. You represent the best of us. And now, because the judge decided, I guess, that they should maybe learn a further lesson, I don't know, they have to go back again on the 14th. And what a great day for some of us folks that have been laboring in the vineyard, if you will, to join them, and to offer them support and to ultimately keep the faith and keep the hope. And before going into that consideration of 1995, let me just go into, because it ties in with this thinking, I think. Yesterday in the admin building was another moving day. And it was the day when a group of perhaps 30, 40 people assembled, young folks, members of the faculty, members of the community. They assembled. And the plan was to deliver the letter that had been signed by 600 to the president of the university. And, you know, I think it would be a good thing for people who are listening, who might like to take an active part in this, maybe not unable to go to court on the 14th of May, but maybe to express support for the young folks who still have the vim, the vigor, the determination, the zeal, strength, energy, enthusiasm for acting, and let the president know what your thoughts are. And the demands center around dropping all charges against the student. I can't imagine that they actually took this into the county by virtue of the Suffolk County Police, but they did. So maybe there's an opportunity for administration to give thought to taking a change of heart and have open discussions. If there's reasons why you as an institution cannot do everything that the students demand, and they do demand interest in the BDS, you know, they do demand that. If there are reasons why you can explain those openly. And there may be reasons why your hands are tied. And we'd have to recognize that, you know, if they are legitimate, if they are true, if they are truly impossibilities, maybe requiring changes in regulation. Oh, boy. That's where the effort of we the people comes in, because the only way that we can change regulations is through our popular vote, which, of course, is being assailed right now. But anyway, okay. So yesterday, the people assembled, and the idea was to take that letter and the list of demands to the president, and the president is up in the building. So the thought was, okay, should we take the elevator, should we take the staircase? And the idea was take the elevator, but as the group moved around, one of the guards that were off in the background, they weren't visible like they were another day at that assembly area. He said, no, the president's office on the second floor. Then we don't have to take the elevator. So then we walked up, and there were a few people who were a little concerned about me. They said, are you okay? I said, oh, yeah, no problem. I said, I'll pass out when we get into the president's office and create a spectacle there. So there was a bit of laughter. I said, hey, you got to keep smiling at all. But anyway, the group moved towards the office, knocked on the door. The door was opened, and the faculty representative had the occasion to deliver verbally, very well spoken, reason for them being there, what the demands were that the students were seeking, and the faculty members that were present. And the people on the inside accepted the letter, accepted the wording. And of course, the assumption is that that will get to the president And the president may say, oh, well, sure, okay, how many were there? 10? Okay, no big deal. 20, 30, no big deal. But if the president is hearing that from other sources, it could prompt the opening up of discussion. And that ultimately is what's going to give us an opportunity to alter our course in whatever ways are possible, or to put it another way, to bend that arc towards justice. And we cannot forget, we're going to be running out of time soon, but we still have enough time to think. The arc is being bent in the courtroom as of Monday, where Donald Trump is being called as a defendant in a criminal case. And it's worth hearing and listening to. And the process of jury selection is going on right now. They've already selected, as of yesterday, they had 7 people. I think they need a total of 18. They are resuming that process today. It's a very involved process. And there's a list of 140 questions that they ask people, trying to determine whether or not a person can cast aside or has no preconceived notion, or if they have some kind of thinking, can they cast it aside and make a final determination just based on the evidence, not based on. Now, of course, the defendant has said, how can I possibly get a fair trial with all the publicity that's been going on? Well, he's the one that created the publicity. So, you know, you created a situation, but that's pretty shrewd, because if you create enough of an issue in that area, so every step that he's taken, if you were an innocent person, you would want to get into court. And you would want to prove in the court, based upon your counter to the evidence that is being presented against you, and you would want to demonstrate that you are innocent, and you would present the reasons why, and you would make your case, and you would win your case. But when you don't want to go there in the first place, it kind of implies something. But we don't rule by implication, we rule by the law. And the law in the court demands the presentation of evidence. So can you, as a juror, cast aside any other notion that you have and just abide by the evidence that is presented and the direction that is given in the court? One thing that they're very wary of at this time, or at least it's been discussed, in the process of selecting the jurors, all you need is one person on that jury to rule in favor of the defendant, and the case will be over. So it's a high bar that the government had, and they're ready to present this high bar according to what? And it's all right to say, well, look, and this is the main defense that's being offered, I'm being persecuted. It's obviously an attempt to interfere with the electoral process. I cannot carry on my campaign. Well, yesterday he didn't have to be in court. He didn't go anywhere. He's asked to get off to go to his son's graduation. They may do that. I don't know. He's asked that he can go to the Supreme Court. Next week, the Supreme Court is going to rule on that final determination having to do with immunity. I'm amazed that they took that in the first place, but they are. And they won't render a decision on that until probably June, or the end of June. So in a sense, they have almost, you could say, they may have cooperated in this idea of delay. You know, justice delayed is justice denied. And who is hurt by this if it goes without full completion? The people who are supposed to be able to gather all the facts necessary to make a sensible choice when the election comes up in November. Now, another thing that's happening today, Fisher is a guy out in the Midwest someplace who brought a case. It's also going to be heard by the Supreme Court, saying that the people who were charged in the insurrection were charged incorrectly, that the law that was used, that they were found guilty of, should perhaps not have been used as a basis for. Now, there are other charges that are involved. It's not as if the Supreme Court rules in favor of Fisher that it'll be over for Trump. No, but it'll mean more trial. It'll mean that Jack Smith's case, which is the case that was aimed at one individual. There were no RICO 15 defendants. The one person was Donald Trump, because the case was being made that he was the person who instigated, sponsored, enabled, aided, abetted, all the rest of it, with the attempt to overthrow the government and to cease and interfere with the peaceful transfer of power from one person to another, to nullify the effect of the election. Okay. So we have a lot going on here, you know. So watch tonight, tomorrow, today and tomorrow. And they say that this case may be ready for arguments on Monday. Trump is saying, wait, it's going too fast. It's going too fast. Slow this train down. Plus, last night, he violated the gag order. I haven't heard reference. I looked at the TV a little bit before. I didn't see reference. They got underway today with the jury selection. I don't know what the judge is going to do that, but it was a clear-cut case. He repeated in his social media a comment made by a Fox News commentator who put out what amounts to a threat to jurors, and then he repeated it. So by repeating it on social media, he is actually, through that social media, extending a threat to jurors. Let's see what the judge does about that. Okay, so much for that little tidbit. Now, let me just go back to our notion of how we're going to heal. We heard about the history. It's complicated. There's no two ways about it. It's involved. It's longstanding. It's taken on all sorts of complications. And I honestly don't know how in the world to get to the bottom of it and to work out an amicable solution. So many wounds, so many intensification of wounds have been presented. And the level of hatred among the two bodies is so high. Yeah? Okay, let me just go back to 1995 and the documentary that has been released just now, having to do with the Oklahoma City bombing. And I watched the people that put it together last night. And as I listened to it, it was very moving. But the concentration was wholly on, and it's warranted, there's no two ways about it, it was wholly on how the city of Oklahoma healed in the aftermath of what happened there when Tim McVeigh and his accomplice, Nichols, I believe was his name, set off the bomb that ripped the building to shreds and killed 23 people. And, of course, the conventional wisdom, the only reason this caught my eye was because the conventional wisdom wants us to, or will result in us. I don't know if it's even like that they want us to, but it will result in us having nothing but heartfelt connection and sympathy for the city as a whole, but particularly for those who lost loved ones in that bombing. And the simplistic view is presented as part of it. Tim McVeigh was a former veteran run amok. Well, yes, that's true. But just like in keeping with our consideration of all that's gone before in connection with Israel and the Palestinians, let's just take a look at Tim McVeigh, and let's take a look at how he got to the point of that he did, all right? Tim McVeigh was a member of the military during the first Iraq war when the Allied forces forced Saddam Hussein and his forces to leave Kuwait. Kuwait, that place that was created by the Brits as they were carving up the region. They were in Kuwait because Kuwait was stealing their oil, all sorts of other things that went on at the time. And they sought approval from the U.S. They got it in the sense that they were told through the ambassador, April Glaspie, that the U.S. would have no fault with what was proposed, because that would be a matter between Arab states. But the British got hold of George Bush Sr., and there was a sudden change in a Rose Garden meeting, but boom, now it became Saddam must get out of Kuwait. Okay. What Saddam asked for that? Would the U.S. object? Okay. Okay, so after many days of whatever they did, bombing, shock and awe, all sorts of stuff, the Iraqi forces were going to retreat out of Kuwait, and they started their retreat. The convoy of soldiers returning to Baghdad was blocked by aircraft that shot up the lead of the convoy. They shot up the rear of the convoy, and then they proceeded to massacre, and they massacred over 10,000 people. It's not an incident that's very well recorded. But it was on. I saw the pictures of the burned bodies in the tanks and all this business. Tim McVeigh was on the burial detail for those 10,000 people. They bulldozed in the sand. They pushed all the bodies, the burned bodies, into the hole. Many of his compatriots on that burial detail saw psychiatric help, you know, in the aftermath, because PTSD, traumatizing action, burying bodies by the ton. Tim McVeigh didn't do that. But he finished his tour. He came back to the U.S., and he heard from many sources who the enemy was. He just came from this traumatizing event with the enemy. But he heard the enemy was big government, and he heard it from people in the administration. He heard it from the likes of J.D. Liddy, who, you know, the guy who burned his finger with a candle to show how strong he was. So anyway, McVeigh's here in the big government, and he went to Ruby Ridge, where government was acting on a man who had violated gun laws. And in trying to capture him, they killed his son and his wife. Okay, he saw that. Oh, and he's reflecting. The enemy is big government. And then it was discovered that Koresh and his following in Waco, Texas, the place where Trump, by the way, sought to open up his campaign. But anyway, it became known that there was something going on there, not good. And this guy, Koresh, had guns. And who in Texas doesn't have a gun? Well, anyway, whatever the immediate surroundings were, Tim McVeigh went there because it became a site of where big government was going to act on Koresh and the followers. They had Branch Davidians, I think they were called. And he was there. It became a lot of right-wingers at that time. The right wing had not developed. The militia movement, all that, had not developed to the extent that it has over these perceived actions not clearly understood, perhaps ill-advised, who knows what the case may be, lack of discussion, lack of transparency. And he saw the place burned down. He saw the tank. He saw the place destroyed. Focusing, thinking, big government is the enemy. And what does he do? He goes off and does Oklahoma City. Horrible thing. Horrible thing. But you see, there was a reason that there was a reason, not an excuse, but there was a reason he got to the mindset that he got to. How did the people that follow Trump get to the mindset that they're in? And how do we get into a mindset that we accept because it's imposed upon us, but finally break out because we're beginning to pick up tidbits, bits and pieces, and we're beginning to research and study? And what should happen in response to that is that there should be open discussion by people who have as their agenda the well-being of the population of their country, while at the same time, a sane manner, way in which that they can impose that policy, that happens to be a matter of foreign interrelations. On some way other than the use of raw power concepts.
I got to jump in here. We are so close to a reset, Bill.
All right.
Let's do it. Sorry.
All right, no problem. Well, I knew the timing was 1:44. We're almost to the end. So let's do a quick reset. We could play a little music. You want to do this in tribute to my friends who are going on a trip? How about Peter, Paul, and Mary leaving on a jet plane? They're leaving tomorrow. And
sweet.
Hope everybody has a safe trip.
This is Lunch on Thursday with Bill McNulty. This is Leaving on a Jet Plane. Here we go. And then I will I'll give out details for that Israel-Palestine history video that Bill played. I'll give out details when we come back.
Terrific. Good. Here we go.
All my bags are packed, I'm ready to go. I'm standing here outside your door. I hate to wake you up to say goodbye, but the dawn is breaking, it's early morn. Taxi's waiting, he's blowing his horn. Already I'm so lonesome I could cry. So kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. I'm leaving on a jet plane. I don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe, I hate to go. There's so many times I've let you down. So many times I've played around. I tell you now, they don't mean a thing. Every place I go, I think of you. Every song I sing for you. When I come back, I'll wear your wedding ring. So kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. I'm leaving on a jet plane. I don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe, I hate to go. Now the time has come to leave you. One more time, let me kiss you. Then close your eyes, I'll be on my way. Dream about the days to come when I won't have to leave alone. About the time I won't have to say. Kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. I'm leaving on a jet plane. I don't know when I'll be back again. Leaving on a jet plane. I don't know when I'll be back again. Leaving on a jet plane. I don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe, I hate to go.
All right. Well, that song, primarily, I just say you're leaving on a jet plane. I played it whenever a friend is going. Some weeks ago, a friend was going over to Ireland and England and Scotland and so on. And this time around, friends are going out to Denver. So I play it primarily because of the reference to leaving on a jet plane, not the rest of it. The rest of it is more or less a love story. So we're not going that far. We're just saying you're leaving on a jet plane. Hope you have a safe trip.
Blast from the past for me, because that was one of the early pieces I played when I was learning how to play piano many, many, many years ago. And it was part of, I just remember, it was part of one of these easy piano songbooks with one of those plastic comb binders, you know, the binder, you know, that sort of thing. And of course, the pages would rip and the pages would fall out, and you're trying to turn the page because leaving on a jet plane was three pages. So you had to turn the page.
Oh, my God. But you mastered the song. You mastered it on the piano.
Well, you know, and I would say mastered in the loosest definition of the word mastered possible. Yes. would say that.
But you play the piano well now, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, you know, since I've retired, I haven't played too much. But no, okay. But I played good enough to get a job.
Well, that's great. I mean, I wish that I had learned it. My father wanted me to learn it, but I had trouble. I think my brain is, I know I have trouble left and right, you know, so that's not so good because you got to know how to work both hands, you know. Now I can play some chords on the piano that identify the chords on the ukulele, see. So I can bang out a couple of songs like, you know, whatever they are, you know.
But it's funny. It's funny, though, because you do have a definite sensibility when it comes to programming the show, though, Bill. So you do have that sixth sense, you know, where you're not just randomly throwing music at the wall to see what sticks. You're
forethought,
you know. Hey, before we get too far into it, we had a call at the station who wanted to know what you played before. And where they can find it. So,
would that be the history lesson?
The history lesson. So, we want to.
Oh, yeah, there's two of them back to back. Yeah, we could furnish that information to folks. Yeah.
So, if you Google the origins of the Israel Palestine conflict, there's two parts to it. I believe the uploader is, it's under a thing called Imperial War Museums. But. Just Google that. It was, and if you're looking at the actual video, there's a British guy there, and he's describing the different armbands and headdresses as well. So he's lecturing on that. So there is that, and there's two parts to it. There is part one and part two. I think part two is under a different uploader. It's called the Balfour Project. So you'll definitely want to check that out. So there's two different uploaders. My wife just brought me a sandwich. Thank you very much.
Oh boy, good. You're making me hungry. Making me hungry.
But anyway, back to you. But that's where you can find it. So that's where you find that. The second part is called Britain and Palestine, which we don't have time to play today.
No, we'll
assume you're gonna want to play it next week. Yeah.
But, if they solve the problem between now and then, we won't. But if they don't solve the problem,
hopefully they will.
Hey, you got to be hopeful, you know. And I am hopeful. Just on that note, though, about Tim McVeigh, I just want to say in conclusion, very very quickly. See, I met Bud Welch. That his daughter, 23-year-old, was killed in that, and I met him when I was out in South Dakota. He went through a epiphany, a healing. He was drunk and full of hate for a year, but he realized it would kill him. And his transformation occurred. And he did go, and they made this clear in the documentary too, but they didn't necessarily dwell on the notion of the healing. He went to Buffalo. He sat with Tim McVeigh's father, and the two of them cried over the loss of their child. And you could lay it at the hands or the feet of the institutions that through this stuff that we heard about in Israel, Palestine, with the Brits and the French and all this stuff. Hey, if you can be open, the most sanitizing thing they say is light, right? Sanitize, let the light in so that we can have the full story. Stop trying to pull the wool over our eyes and don't try to manufacture the consent so that we fall in line and do your bidding. We will do, and we will disobey the law. In imitation of Romero, when he said, disobey your superiors, pay attention to a higher law, stop killing your brothers and sisters. And then we cast aside this idea because diversity means that we are in the midst, in a democratic process, of brothers and sisters. So on that note, let me just say, since we're close to the end, I just want to say I'm going to be on a Zoom call with the folks. I don't know how Albany went in connection with this, but representatives from students throughout the SUNY system, in connection with the same issue that the Stony Brook students raised, came together last Monday when two of the arrestees were allowed to go there. But the others could not because they had to be in court. The whole group will have to be in court on the 14th of May. That's about it for now. Do we have time for music, or should we just sum up with a summary of what's coming for the listeners if they stay tuned to WUSB for the remainder of the day? Captain?
Well, really quickly, we can say that Chris Sorochin is in studio right now, 631-632-6901. And he can take your calls for pledging in the next 5 minutes. And then his show starts at 1 o'clock. At 3 o'clock, Captain Phil's Planet is going to happen.
Okay.
And I have a exciting interview happening with Peter Boyer and Jeffrey Beagle, who are the composer and concert pianist for a new piece called Rhapsody in Red, White, and Blue, which is a patriotic interpretation and tribute to George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, which celebrated its 100 years since being written in 1924.
Wow, so, my father's favorite song. He used to play that on the piano, Rhapsody in Blue.
Oh, fantastic. So this is, we're going to be talking with the composer and with the pianist, and I'll be playing the piece afterwards. That's Captain Phil's Planet. And then, of course, at 5 o'clock, Amy Goodman, Democracy Now!, Sounds of Film, Chris Sorochin, and topping off the day with reggae, followed by you-know-who, our BFF forever, Cut Supreme, with the best hip-hop you ever heard here on WUSB Stony Brook. Yeah, we do have a little time to play a short song.
Hey, you want to play, you want to go out with, you know, since we're wrapped up in law, do you want to go out with I Fought the Law?
We can definitely do that. The timing works out perfectly. You even have another minute or two to do final closing thoughts.
Well, the closing thoughts would be thank you for listening, and hats off to those who pulled out the technical difficulties out of the fire early in the show. Very capable folks. And I will personally look forward to being back with you in a week's time. And thank you, Captain Phil, because you always make things run smoothly. And I do appreciate that and appreciate your help on a weekly basis.
Well, I appreciate having a reason to get up on Thursdays. And,
good. Well, like Trump, you can't sleep forever.
That's true. That is absolutely true. So thanks again, Bill. Looking forward to next week again. Just real quick, that would be British in Palestine, the Balfour Project. That would be the one upload, and the other one was the Origins of the Israel-Palestine Conflict. That's what Bill played today, that part one, and we may or may not be playing that next week, depending on what Bill wants to do. And again, go ahead, Bill.
Keep it on your file if you can. I'll keep it on my file, that other one, and we'll see if we use it. Yeah,
absolutely. And again, it is pledge time, 631-632-6901. And as a tribute to our very sleepy friend in New York City right now, who may be nodding off as we speak, I Fought the Law, and the law won the Bobby Fuller Four. Thanks again, Bill. See you next week.
All right. Thank you, folks, for listening, and thank you, Captain Phil.
Good afternoon. I get like 10 seconds extra. One, I guess that's